Cale Clark here. Thanks for listening to my podcast. Check out Charity Mobile and prayerfully consider making them your wireless carrier. Mention offer code Relevant Radio and get a free phone. Don't delay. CharityMobile.com. That's CharityMobile.com.
Fascinating facts, candid conversations, and some levity to lighten your day. This is the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio.
A fantastic Friday to you. It is March the 18th, 2022. So glad to be back in the chair live today. And you can call in right now, 888-914-9149, toll free. Talk to me or my guest, who I'll introduce in just a moment, 888-914-9149. You can also email the program. It's a great place to send questions and show ideas. Cale, C-A-L-E, at relevantradio.com. And you can follow me on Twitter, as always. Grab onto that handle, at Cale Clark, C-A-L-E, Clark with an E. And the show account is there as well, at Cale Clark Show. Well, one thing that I saw in the news recently, which was of great interest to me, Nathan Steinmeier, writing for biblicalarchaeology.org, that's the website of the Biblical Archaeology Society, talked about a number of stolen artifacts from the ancient world that do have some reference to the Bible that were recovered recently. This happened earlier this year, and the Israel Antiquities Authority, also known as the IAA, raided a home in Jerusalem. And basically what they found there was a hoard of stolen artifacts. And they go back to the biblical period. Some of them were 1,500 years old. There were 1,500-year-old magic bowls. Now, you say, what are magic bowls? Well, we'll explain. Some of these magic bowls that have been found in antiquity actually have reference to Jesus and these magic spells and incantations. Well, what on earth is that all about? We're going to explain that in just a second. But also, in this treasure trove of artifacts that were recovered, that were stolen, a number of ivories were found as well. And biblical ivories are really important, too. We'll talk about that in just a second. But basically what this guy was doing in Jerusalem was he had gotten these stolen artifacts on the black market, and he was trying to repair them in his home and wanted to resell them. And so, anyways, luckily these were found. There is a big trade in stolen artifacts these days, so it's a little bit like a mystery. I don't know. I was going to say Dan Brown, but we don't want Dan Brown. We want somebody else who's I don't know, more orthodox writer, shall we say, to explain all this. But it sounds like a mystery story or a movie. And joining me right now to talk about this is a great friend of the program, author, editor of well over 90 books, including Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence, and the really beautifully done reference work, Jesus and the Manuscripts, published by Hendrickson. Dr. Craig Evans joins me from his home in Houston, Texas. Dr. Evans, thanks for taking the time. How are you?
Hey, I'm good, Cale. Good to be with you.
Absolutely, as always. And talk to me a little bit about some of these stolen artifacts that were recovered in Israel. First of all, tell me about some of these ivories. Why is carved ivory really important in terms of...
Well, that was a luxury item in 3,000 years ago. Hmm. And the prophets in the Old Testament referred to it. That's one of the ways you can criticize the wealthy who oppress the poor, who chase after other gods, who flirt with heathen and worship their gods and so on. Today we say, you know, they're limousine liberals, they fly in their private jets, they go to Davos and eat, you know, caviar and drink champagne and then complain about all the rest of us poor schlubs that commute to work and use fossil fuel. Well, in 3,000 years ago, the elite, you know, reclined on couches made of ivory. They had their artwork. They had all this and that. And of course, they, you know, hey, it was hard. They had to, you know, scrounge and scrimp and get their money together to buy these things and crack the whip and make all the poor people work real hard. And so the prophets would zero in on them. Well, it's really neat if we can find some of these things. They were valuable. They are somewhat fragile. And here are some very nice pieces that had been looted. And we're in possession of this collector. So I'm really glad these have been recovered. A lot of them are museum-quality pieces. Well, Cale, next time we're in Israel, we might see them
in
the Israel Museum. So I'm really glad that the IAEA is vigilant, and you know, I think they can improve on their policies, actually, and the way they relate to looters, past and present. But I'm really glad they've been recovered. It's quite a catch.
Yeah, how can they improve on their policies, the IAEA, with respect to looters? What do you mean by that?
Well, there are a lot of Palestinian kids and West Bank types and so on that they're scrounging around looking for things that they, you know, bottles and cans. They have metal detectors in some cases, and they find coins, they find pottery, they find a tomb, they crawl into it, they discover an ossuary, they find maybe some coins. Of course, real treasures like fragments of Dead Sea Scrolls and so on. Well, the trouble is, if they do find something, they have no motivation to report it. There's no reward, and indeed, they flirt with the possibility of punishment. And Herschel Shanks, who passed away recently, as you know, you know, you knew Herschel, and so did I, founder of the very website we're talking about, the Biblical Archaeology Society, the Biblical Archaeology Review magazine. He always was critical of the IAEA policy. The policy should be, look, if you find something and report it, you will be rewarded. And I think that would have that would change the whole dynamic. And and so if people find something, they know, well, I'm not going to report this to the IAEA. I'll not only not get anything, I'll probably be in trouble. So they steal it and sell it to an antiquities dealer or somebody like that. And that's what happens. And so they're highly motivated to break the law. So I think they need to rethink that, change it, turn it into a situation where you're rewarded and you're not punished. So if you find something and report it, hooray. If you find something and turn it in, you know, you're rewarded for that. I think that would be good policy. But what this guy was doing, he was collecting things he knew had been looted, had been stolen. And so I'm really glad that it fell into the hands of the authorities. Now scholars can study them. But, you know, if you read the article, someone expresses disappointment because when things are looted, we don't know where they came from.
That's right, yeah.
We've lost the context. You remember 20 years ago when everybody was talking about the James ossuary. Well, arguably that's the most important artifact ever found that could relate to the Holy Family. I mean, there is a chance that we're talking about none other than James or Jacob, the brother of Jesus, who ran the church, guided the church for 20 years from the early 40s till his martyrdom in the early 60s. And the ossuary says, Jacob or James, son of Joseph, brother of Jesus. Well, that's hugely significant. But we don't know where it came from. It was looted. We have no idea where it was found, when it was found. We can't study the context in which it was found. You ended up with rumors that, who knows, maybe it came from the Talpiot tomb, and that whole thing turned into a joke. You know, Jesus' wife, Mary, was in that tomb, too. I mean, the whole thing just went crazy.
Yeah,
that's what looting does, and you lose the context. And so, yeah, we have the artifact, and yes, the inscription, as it turns out, is authentic, but we don't have the context in which it was found, and that's a big loss.
Yeah, that is certainly true. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Dr. Craig Evans. And Dr. Evans, you and I have worked on archaeological digs together in Jerusalem, outside of Jerusalem. And it's so important, as you said, for the provenance of these finds. When they're stolen, when they're taken out of context, we really don't know a lot of the story about these artifacts. But something you just mentioned earlier with respect to the James ossuary, the Talpiot tomb, for our listeners who may not be familiar with that, can you tell us the story about that?
Well, that was in the news big time. There was a book by a chap named James Tabor in 06. In 07, there was a documentary by Simcha Yakubovich, a Jewish filmmaker. And it was a sensationalized attempt to talk about this tomb. It's south of Jerusalem a little bit in a neighborhood called Talpiot. And this was a tomb that was found in 1980. It was excavated. Actually, it had been partly looted. Even then, and some ossuaries were discovered. Some of them had inscriptions on them. And it was no big deal. That was 1980, and then it sort of gets rediscovered just 15 years ago or something like that, and we get this documentary saying, oh, look at this, the name Jesus is on one ossuary, the name Judah, son of Jesus, is on another ossuary. There's an ossuary with Mary written on it.
Mm-hmm.
My goodness, this is probably the family of Jesus. Jesus, his wife Mary, and their son Judah. I mean, there was no basis for making this kind mm-hmm. of an argument. And it was sensationalized. And, of course, scholars debunked it.
Yep.
But, you know, Simca, I know Simca. I've debated him on television. You know, he was beating the drum and trying to make it sound like the family of Jesus finally been found. And, oh, by the way, the bone box in which Jesus' unresurrected body was placed, complete with a few bone chips. I mean, you know, there you go. And so I don't think there was any question. There was an agenda there. Let's debunk Christianity while we're at it. But the stolen James ossuary, you know, we don't know where it came from. And was it really from the Talpiot tomb? I don't think so. But anyway, this is what happens when you have stuff stolen, looted, vandalized, sold on the black market. Then it creates, because there is no context, it creates the opportunity for sensational theories to be proposed. I've always told my students, you know, if you want to create a cult, all you need is a Bible and no context. Well, if you want to create a fad, all you need is an artifact, an archaeological artifact, and no context, and you can say almost anything.
Yeah, and we do hit, since we're in Lent right now, we're leading up to Holy Week and Easter. These theories come out of the woodwork, it seems, every year, just as surely as the Easter lilies pop up. So I can't wait to see what happens this year. But yeah, I remember a few years ago when Simca was pushing this, and he calls himself the naked archaeologist. So I wrote a little article about it at the time saying the naked archaeologist has no clothes, and he certainly was exposed, as it were. There's no doubt that that was fraudulent, the whole Talpiot tomb thing and the alleged family of Jesus. My goodness. But my guest on the Cale Clark Show right now is Dr. Craig Evans. If you have a question for Dr. Evans about Jesus and history, archaeology, why not call in right now? 888-914-9149. So we talked about these stolen artifacts that were recovered. We talked about the ivory. And this might have been exactly the type of stuff that talks about in 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 22, this idea of Solomon's trade ships bringing back ivories from voyages. The prophets also really denounced these ivories as symbols of greed. We talked about that. But I want to talk about some other finds among these stolen artifacts that were recovered by the Israel Antiquities Authority, the magic bowls. Now, when we hear about magic bowls, what kind of magic are we talking about here? And what do the bowls have to do with it, Dr. Evans?
Oh, man, that is such a fascinating topic because magic shows up in a variety of ways. Bowls, just one of them. You have magic cups. You have magical papyri. You have metal foils made of gold, lead, silver, or tin. You have leather straps called phylacteries. You have all sorts of things, and they're designed to either bring you good luck, drive away bad luck, or more diabolically, to keep demons away. Now, some of it is black magic, and that's actually to send an evil spirit or the spirit of a restless, wicked, dead person, to send that spirit and attack somebody, to bring illness on somebody. I mean, you get some really weird stuff. And the magic bowls, they are mostly Jewish, written in a type of Aramaic for the most part, and they mostly date, they don't go back like these ivories 3,000 years ago. These only go back 14, 15 centuries. Hmm. They're mostly found in Iraq. They somehow, through all the looting, especially after Saddam Hussein was overthrown, and then later the ISIS problem, they get looted and they migrate westward because there are antiquities dealers, purchasers, and so on. And these magic bowls, I've published a couple of them. They're fascinating. You have a circular writing that winds its way down to the bottom of the bowl.
Yeah.
At the bottom of the bowl, this is the inside of the bowl. Then you might have a picture that depicts either the evil spirit that you are calling for or the victim or you're trying to target. And, you know, it's almost like having a voodoo doll with pins in it, and it's sketched in the bottom. And These things are really strange, and we study them, and we learn a lot about the culture, a lot about illness, disease, their fears, religious beliefs, beliefs about gods, spirits. And Kale, sometimes, these are Jewish now, they're not Christian, sometimes they invoke Jesus for help against an evil spirit or against an illness. So yeah. I find that, and Jesus shows up in some of these other magical materials. And I find that very fascinating.
Oh, it certainly is. My guest is Dr. Craig Evans, biblical scholar. You can call in right now if you have a question for him, 888-914-9149. Yeah, I actually posted a picture, Dr. Evans, on my Twitter account, just promoting your appearance on tonight's show. I did post a picture of what one of these magic bowls looks like. Obviously, we're on radio here, so you're just going to have to Google some of these images, or you can check out the sample that I put on my account there, and it has a picture on the bottom, just like you said, the winding script around the inside of the bowl. Usually the only thing that's like sort of on the inside of my bowls is like pieces of dried Fruit Loops and things like that. So, but this is a little bit more interesting in these magic bowls. And so I want to ask you about this idea of Jesus in these magical materials. And so it's not necessarily a bowl, it's more of a cup. I want to ask you about what was discovered by the French marine archaeologist Frank Gadio in 2008.
Well, you know, that was one of the most interesting discoveries, and it's still being talked about. It was called the Jesus Cup. That's a little bit misleading because the name Jesus isn't on the cup. But I communicated with Frank and some of his other colleagues. It's the Oxford Marine Archaeology Department. And it's Alexandria, Egypt, that we're talking about. Alexandria was the city in antiquity for centuries, founded by and named after Alexander, who conquered the Middle East in the 4th century B.C. And Alexandria became a very well-established harbor, had a famous library of several hundred thousand books. So it was quite the place. And Egypt acquired the unsavory reputation of being the magic capital of the world.
Hmm.
Yeah, and so that actually comes into play, I think, on this. When this cup was found, here's what it actually says. There is no verb, and you have to supply the verb. But on one, it says this, the magician through Christ. That's what it says in Greek. Very
magician
easy to read
Christ.
Greek. The word magician is spelled a little bit strangely, but then spelling wasn't that standardized in antiquity.
Mm-hmm.
The
mm-hmm.
cup itself, the ceramic cup, is dated, we think, to somewhere around 100 B.C., maybe 150,
wow.
And sometime in the 1st century A.D., someone scratched these Greek letters, these Greek words, on the outside of the cup. And so it's ho goistes diakristou, the chanter through Christ. And if you insert a verb, it probably means speaks or has his power or does whatever he does. Someone has upgraded this cup, increased its power. I mean, it used to be magic 1-0, now it's magic 2-0, by adding through Christ on it. Now, that's fascinating. And they did it in Egypt, and the cup got lost in the water, in the harbor, in about 25 feet of water, where it stayed in the sand for the next 18 centuries until Frank and his group at Oxford sucked it up out of the sandy bottom and found it. It used to have two handles. One of them's broken off. So I've seen it. I have beautiful photos of both sides. I've published it, and I've talked about it. And I don't think there's any doubt that diakristou, the through Christ, is referring to Jesus, even though Jesus, the name Jesus, doesn't appear. So this is, I think, one more testimonial to the reputation Jesus has as a powerful name that can heal, drive away evil spirits, or predict the future, or provide advice, or whatever. Jesus' name was a potent name, even outside the church. So you have, I mean, you know, the Gospel of Mark, chapter 9, talks about two disciples, James and John, complained to Jesus, Master, we saw a man invoking your name to cast out evil spirits, and we told him to stop. Isn't that interesting? And so Jesus had such a reputation during his ministry that people who were not even part of his following were using his name to effect cures, exorcisms, and things like that. And so even after the New Testament is written, after the church gets underway, you have people outside the church, Jews, pagans, whatever, invoking the name of Jesus for healing and protection against evil spirits.
Wow, that is absolutely fascinating historical truth to note. My guest is Dr. Craig Evans. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. We'll have much more along with your questions. You can call in as well if you have a question for the good doctor. 1-888-914-9149. We'll be right back after this quick break. Today, we'd like to thank Mario, who's listening in South Carolina, for donating his Oldsmobile. You can join thousands of other listeners in donating old vehicles by visiting relevantradio.com/car.
This is The Cale Clark Show, giving you the confidence you need to bring the faith into everyday life.
Hey, welcome back to the program. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. Dr. Craig Evans, biblical scholar, is my guest. We're having a fascinating conversation about Jesus' historical artifacts, some really fascinating items from the past that were looted, were recovered by the Israel Antiquities Authority, a number of ivories from the biblical period, also some magic bowls. And we were just having a conversation about Jesus being named in some of these magicians' cups and bowls. Even non-Christians recognized the power of Jesus and wanted to invoke his name. And Dr. Evans, we got a call on the line here. Father Joe is calling from Bayhead, New Jersey. Hi, Father Joe. Welcome back to the program.
How you doing, Cale?
Oh, great. It's good to talk to you again. Thanks for calling in. Got a question for Dr. Evans here?
Yes, I do. Dr. Evans, do you think that Jesus was familiar with the Dead Sea Scrolls community at Qumran because of the sort of the parallel with the Last Supper and the communal meal at Qumran? Hmm. And do you think he probably or maybe grew up and learned a lot from them? So that's my question. What do you think the connection was?
Good question. Excellent question. Scholars have been asking that question since the scrolls were discovered. The first cave was discovered, we think, in 47, and scholars became aware of this discovery late 47, early 48. And then 10 more caves were discovered with scrolls. The big cave, of course, was cave number 4, found in 52. And now we have just under 1,000 texts from Qumran and the neighboring communities, northwest shore of the Dead Sea region. And we noticed a lot of similarities right away. The focus on Isaiah 40, verse 3, prepare the way of the Lord in the wilderness, make straight his paths. And people are, wow, isn't that interesting? John the Baptist cites that. He's in the wilderness. He quotes Isaiah 40, verse 3. He's into water immersion. So's the Qumran guys. Sacred meals at Qumran. Ooh, interesting. The Eucharist in the early church. Wow. You know, and it goes on and on. And there's a dualism, good spirit, bad spirit, you know, that kind of thing. And so there are a number of parallels that have led some very sober, careful scholars, the late Joseph Fitzmyer, for example, outstanding scholar, a master of Qumran material, excellent in biblical languages, he concluded that there's a very good chance that John the Baptist, as a youth, had connections with the Qumran community. And if he did, and given the relationship between John and Jesus, then I would have to say Jesus, of course, knew of the Essenes, and I do identify the Essenes that Josephus talks about, the Jewish historian, and other writers in antiquity. They talk about this Jewish group priestly oriented group called the Essenes, probably from the Hebrew participle mean doer, doers of the word, doers of the covenant. Anyway, I think Jesus knew of them. The mystery is why he never references them. Why we have stories about Pharisees asking Jesus a question, or Sadducees, or scribes, but we have no story in the Gospels where an Essene approaches Jesus, at least identified as an Essene. We don't. So, Father Joe, when your question actually is a whole series of questions. So, did he know about the Essenes? Sure, I think it's very likely. Did he ever meet an Essene? Probably. Josephus and other sources tell us that the Essenes had a section in Jerusalem where they lived. So he probably knew of them, had met some of them. Did Jesus himself ever go to Qumran, out in the wilderness near the Dead Sea, and visit their community? That we don't know. That's just pure speculation. Maybe, but we just don't know. The other thing that needs to be pointed out is Jesus and the Essenes saw things very, very differently. Jesus associated with people that were called sinners, people who, tax collectors, people who, in fact, even prostitutes in some cases. He would eat meals with them. No Essene would ever do anything like that. The Essenes viewed Pharisees as liberal and wishy-washy, and you think, wow, how can that be? They come across very legalistic and very strict. And so I would say socially, Jesus and the Essenes were miles apart in a lot of ways, even if they saw things similarly, like eschatology, certain prophecies, certain passages about restoration of Israel. I think they're on the same page. But in a lot of other ways, they're very different. So your question is a complicated one. It's a good one. And thanks to the scrolls and ongoing work in archaeology and interpretation of scrolls, we're starting to answer some of these questions better. But there's still questions that remain.
Yeah, that's really well said, Dr. Evans. Thanks very much, Father Joe, for that great question. Call back anytime. Yeah, and as anybody knows who's been to Israel, who's been to Qumran, and you and I have both been there, Dr. Evans, there's actually a little movie theater that you go to on site, and they do ask that question. What if John the Baptist actually came out here to the desert community of Qumran and hung out? We'll never know. We'll never know. But speaking of that, Dr. Evans, something I just want to get back to something we were chatting about before the break. Obviously, there were a number of strains, if you will, of Judaism during Jesus' day. There's Pharisaical Judaism, of course. There is, of course, the Essenes that we just talked about. Obviously, the Sadducees in control of the temple establishment. They had some radically different views on things like the afterlife than Jesus. But also, it's fascinating to me when you were talking about Jesus being mentioned in these magic bowls that have been found from antiquity. One of the things that you said was that there were some Jewish groups that were into magic bowls. Why would they be doing this, and how does that cohere with their view of the one true God? What is this all about?
Well, that's a great question, and I have some theories and some ideas, and Christianity begins in a totally Jewish context. Jesus, the 12, his whole family, all of his earliest followers, every single one of them's ethnic Jew. And so there are Jewish Christian groups, Messianic Jews, right on into the Byzantine period in the Middle Ages. So Jesus is known in the Jewish community, and a majority of Jews who take their faith seriously and attend the synagogue have decided that Jesus isn't the Messiah, because Rome was not overthrown, and so they don't see Jesus, probably through the popular lens of a conqueror. He didn't do that. He led no army. He didn't defeat Caesar, so he's not really the Messiah. He died on a cross. I mean, how do you explain that? And so the Jewish community knows about Jesus, and I've read the Jewish literature, the Talmud, and some of the Midrash, the commentary on Scripture. They know who Jesus is, and of course they try to diss him. Oh, well, he was born out of wedlock. He went to Egypt and learned magic, and so there we are with the Egyptian connection again. And so they know about him. But what's so interesting, even though Jesus is formally rejected in the synagogue, and John's gospel, I think, reflects that, even though Jesus is rejected in the synagogue and the Jewish people are encouraged not to believe in him, nonetheless, they appeal to him. And I think it's because within Judaism, it's known that, man, Jesus is powerful. In his name, people are healed. In his name, evil spirits are driven away. And so even though the rabbis frown on it, the synagogue frowns on it, on the side, people do things. And, you know, that's human nature. And there's a pragmatic element to illness and medicine. You try anything.
Yeah.
And isn't that the way people are today?
Yeah.
You know, they go to the internet, they self-diagnose, they look for things. They might not want to admit it to their rabbi or to their priest, but there they are, out hunting around, trying to figure out, find a solution. And I think that's what happened. I think these magical materials, see, we see magic and we have an idea like, oh, this is mumbo jumbo, it's strange. That's not how they saw it. It's medicine. It's homeopathic. You know what I mean? They're being pragmatic. And it's like, I can't get rid of this fever. I can't get rid of this paralysis. I can't get rid of whatever this is. I'll try anything. And I know somebody who became a believer in Jesus, and I don't know, good things have happened to that person, so I'm going to try Jesus for myself. I'll still go to the synagogue, and I won't admit it to anybody, but on the side, I will hire somebody to write out a formula for me or write out one of these magic bowls, and I'll pay a lot of money for it, and man, I hope it does the trick. So I think that's what it is in part.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. You're listening to The Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio. My guest is Dr. Craig Evans. And just one more thing, when you were talking about the commentaries of the rabbis known as the Midrash, I always thought it was really funny. In the classroom, you would start scratching your belly when you were talking about the Midrash. And eventually people would catch on that you had a Midrash. But anyways, let me just one final question about these magic bowls that mention Jesus. Some of them are from Jewish sources, some of them not. Recently on this program, I was talking about how there is historical evidence for Jesus outside of the Bible. There are a few cranks out there that say that Jesus never existed, but they're extremely rare. And one of the ways we can disprove that is by referencing all the ancient writers who were not believers in Jesus, who wrote about him and his activities. He was certainly a historical person. Does the existence of Jesus' name being invoked in these magic bowls, does that tell us anything about the historical Jesus?
Yeah, I think it does. I mean, you have continuity. The earliest magical reference, it's a tie. I don't know which one's the earliest. We've already mentioned the Jesus cup, the magician's cup. That cup, the style of writing on it, puts it in the first century A.D. I mean, it would even be first century, early first century, but that's too early. You know, no one knows about Christ in Egypt until you get into the 30s of the first century. And then there's a papyrus found in Egypt. It's a charm against evil spirits. And in it, I think it's line 20 or 21, it says, here's what you say. You say, I adjure you, and the Greek word is exorcisto, where we get exorcist.
Wow.
I adjure you by the God of the Hebrews, the Jewish people, Jesus. So this pagan who wrote this doesn't know Judaism very well, doesn't know Christianity very well. But what he does know is that Jesus is like a deity. Jesus is God. And if you want to drive away this evil spirit, you invoke his name. And, of course, there's a lot of mumbo-jumbo and magical words and so on, abracadabra kind of stuff. But here's what's interesting, Cale. In setting it up, it goes on to say, you know, it's invoking the Jewish tradition, the prophets. Jeremiah is actually mentioned. But it talks about the Jewish temple, all in the present tense, the eternal flame is still burning on the altar. That takes us back to the law, the books of Moses, where this fire is always to burn, the unquenchable fire by the altar. And so when this charm is written out, the temple is still standing. And as you know, it stood until the year 70 when the Romans destroyed it, 70 AD, in the first century.
Yeah.
So somewhere between 30 and 70, this charm is written. Somewhere between that time, too, the magic cup is inscribed, and both of these come from Egypt. So this tells us first century Egyptians who were into magic knew that the name of Jesus was potent, and if your magic is going to work, you invoke his name. And, of course, they're theologically way off base. They aren't Christians. They don't know what they're talking about. They're not members of the church. But what they do know, it's kind of a street knowledge. Anybody in the street knows that the name of Jesus is powerful. And Cale, you know perfectly well, in the book of Acts, chapter 19, you have exactly that.
I was just thinking about that, yeah.
Yeah, Paul, you know, and his group, there they are preaching. They're not in Israel. They're not in Egypt. They're up north. They're in Asia Minor. And they're in Ephesus, actually, which is in Asia Minor today, or Turkey today. And these professional exorcists who happen to be Jewish, and they're seven sons of a Jewish priest, and they see, look at this guy. They know Paul's a Jew.
Yep.
So they think, okay, he probably, you know, Jews usually know what they're doing when it comes to healing and exorcism. And they keep appealing to someone named Yeshua. I don't know who that is. But, man, they get results. And so these sons of Sceva, you know, they believe in continuing ed. And so they're observing this, thinking, okay, write that down. It's some guy named Paul who keeps invoking somebody, some spirit named Yeshua. And, man, it works. And so this is what we're talking about. And so Acts 19 is a very early testimony to what we see in actual archaeological artifacts, two of which we're talking about right now, that happened to be in Egypt. And by the way, it's always Egypt because that's where stuff survives. That's where papyri survives for hundreds, even thousands of years. If the same conditions existed elsewhere, like in Italy and Greece and Turkey, we would have more papyri and dozens more artifacts telling us the same thing, where people invoke Jesus' name for healing.
Yeah, that's all great stuff. Yeah, these exorcists try to invoke the name of Jesus, and this demon says to them, "Yeah, Jesus I know, and Paul I know, but who the heck are you guys?" And then it's very strange. He basically beats the heck out of them, and they run out of the house naked and bleeding. It's very ominous. And on that very ominous note, we got to take a quick break here on the Cale Clark Show. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. We'll be right back with my guest, Dr. Craig Emmons.
Explaining the faith so you can explain it to others. It's the Cale Clark Show on Relevant Radio and the Relevant Radio app.
Hey, welcome back. 888-914-9149 is the number to call. My guest today is Dr. Craig Emmons, biblical scholar. We're talking about Jesus and archaeology, some of the really amazing finds that have shed some light on Jesus and his world. And that's the title of one of Dr. Evans' books, by the way, Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. And Dr. Evans, speaking of Jesus and archaeology, the Bible and archaeology, it's been very common over the years for Muslim apologists to try to say that there was no temple on the Temple Mount, where the Dome of the Rock is right now in Jerusalem. There never was a Jewish temple there. It was in another place, perhaps. And lately, it's been really trendy now, even for amateur Christian archaeologists, and I use the word amateur, I underline that, I want to highlight that, they're starting to say the same thing, that there was no Jewish temple at the top of the mount. And I know that you're working on something right now with archaeologist Scott Stripling, kind of dealing with all that. Can you talk to us about that a little bit?
Well, yeah, I can. This is strange to me, really strange. And by the way, Muslims never denied the existence of the Jewish temple until very recently. This is something that's only in the last 50, 60 years. So it's a new idea.
Okay.
It's part of a drive against the Jewish people is what it is. I think it's in reaction to the Jewish state becoming a country again in 1948. Anyway, it's nonsense. There's nothing to it. Because when you go up on the Temple Mount, you and I have been there before. There's plenty of evidence. We have some of the original stones, not only that Herod built in the first century B.C. when he redid the Second Temple, but we actually have stones that reach all the way back, possibly some of the beams that go all the way back to the first temple that Solomon himself built. But we have tremendous evidence for the temple on top of the Temple Mount. But what's going on is there's a legendary writing called the Epistle of Aristeas. No modern scholar thinks it's authentic. It's fictional. It's somebody that wrote it around 100, 120 B.C. And trying to make it sound like he's a Gentile in Egypt who visited Jerusalem and was really, really impressed. It's a piece of apologetic. And he refers to the temple having water gushing up in the temple precincts. Well, there is no water source on top of the Temple Mount. It's right on the top. Springs are below, not above. Well, there is a spring, the well-known Gihon Spring, the legendary Hezekiah's Tunnel connected to that. And this water rushes into various places like the Siloam Pool. And so the theory is maybe the temple wasn't on top of the Temple Mount, but down the hill, moving southward. And that would then fulfill this description in the Epistle of Aristeas, because there then could be water gushing up from the temple courts. The trouble is there are no temple courts. There's nothing there. And all of the archaeology that relates to the temple, including an inscription that we're actually told about in Josephus, and we have found it to the place of trumpeting, was found right there on top at the Temple Mount, as well as a number of other stones, artifacts, a golden bell that looks like a pomegranate that the priest would wear on his robe, found right there, and many other things. And so anyway, I've been involved with Scott Stripling. He's an archaeologist. I know something about the literature, including the Epistle of Aristeas, some of the other Greek and Roman writings and so on, and we've done a study on this. These are decent Christian people, Protestants and Catholics alike, who are saying maybe we should envision the temple at one time a couple hundred meters further south down the hill. Maybe what used to be on top of the hill where the Dome of the Rock now stands used to be where the Roman army was garrisoned or something like that. But, Cale, this is screwy. we got to stop this in its tracks because it unwittingly contributes to the Islamic apologetic that basically says the Jewish people have no right to be in Jerusalem or in Israel because they have no history. They never even had a temple there. And this is terrible. We can't let that go on.
Yeah, and it's good that you got. And when is the article actually coming out, and what publication?
Yeah, it just came out in the Near Eastern Archaeology Bulletin, Society Bulletin. Just came out.
Yeah, and I'm glad you're talking about it here because, yeah, eventually there will be YouTube videos about stuff like this trying to float this theory. So I'm glad that you guys are refuting that. And Dr. Evans, we're almost out of time, but I just want to tell people if they want to follow Dr. Evans on Twitter, they can do so at Dr. Craig A. Evans, at Dr. Craig A. Evans. And the website is craigaevans.com, and obviously his books can be found pretty much anywhere on Amazon. His latest is Jesus and the Manuscripts, which is just a beautifully illustrated. It's kind of a keepsake. I'm always scared I'm going to spill coffee on it. It's got so many beautiful manuscript illustrations. Dr. Evans, thank you so much for taking the time today.
You're very welcome, Cale. Always a pleasure.
Fantastic. Likewise, that was the great Dr. Craig Evans joining me live from his home in Houston, Texas. And, well, we've had a great week on the Cale Clark Show, and Jim Shaper, our new producer, has gotten his feet wet, and he has taken a stab for the very first time at coming up with the week that was on the Cale Clark Show. Here it is.
what happens after you die? Now check this out. This is Lex Fridman interviewing Mark Zuckerberg on his podcast. Check this out.
At the moment of your death, you get to meet God, and you get to ask one question. What question would you like to ask?
Well, if it's only one question and I died, I would just want to know that Priscilla and my family, like, if they were going to be okay.
Yeah, I think God would hear that question and be like, all right, fine, you get in.
Zuckerberg went on to say in this interview that before he had a family, running the enterprise of Facebook, which is now called Meta, was the most meta thing in his life. We're going to go to Mary Alice, who's calling from Columbus, Ohio.
If I were to be able to ask God, why does God bring all these wonderful people into our lives only to have them taken away through death?
You know, one of the things it says about Jesus in the book of Revelation, it says, Jesus says, I hold the keys of death and of Hades. And so hopefully we will have answers on the other side as to the timing. Why now, Lord? Why this person? Why at this time? And be ready ourselves for that moment of stepping beyond the curtain, because we don't know when that might be for ourselves. My wife, Trish, had taken Egbert to the vet, and as we feared, it was really, really bad news. He's really taken a nosedive. Sure enough, we got the news that, there's nothing they can do for him, and so this is kind of the end. So we're kind of asking the question, you know, how do we break this to our daughter, to Michaela, who's 6 years old, and this is her puppy. She's known Egbert ever since she was a baby, right? So we've been asking for the intercession of St. Francis, and you know, dogs don't have eternal souls like people do, but they can really become an important part of the family, as you know, if you're a dog owner. And if you're not a dog lover, well, if you're a cat lover, I'll pray for you. I'm only kidding. Hey, come on, your cat doesn't even like you. It always runs under the bed when you come home, right? It's not that way with a dog. A team that is well known in the Chicago area and all around the country now, Loyola University of Chicago, another Jesuit school. Most people know them for having this incredible Cinderella run in the 2018 tournament. They made the Sweet 16 last year, so they followed it up. But most people know them because of Sister Jean, who is... How old is Sister Jean right now?
How much time left in show, Jim?
102 years old. Many of you have seen her. She's still apparently sharp as a tack. You see her sitting in her Loyola of Chicago colored scarf, which is kind of like a Harry Potter color. She is the chaplain of the Loyola of Chicago Ramblers team. Okay, hey, well, thank you, Jim, for putting that together the week that was on the Cale Clark Show. Yeah, and that's why I wasn't here yesterday. We did have to put Egbert to sleep, and it was kind of a bittersweet day. But I want to thank everybody who sent me an email, who called in, who maybe sent me a message on Twitter. Really, really appreciate you guys. Yeah, it was a tough day for our family, but there are much bigger problems in the world, obviously. But I really do appreciate you guys and your support. And yeah, it was kind of a bittersweet day, and it was almost like a wake in a certain sense. All kinds of family members came over to say goodbye to Egbert, and everybody loved him a lot. He was a great dog, and he was the official mascot of the Cale Clark Show. And speaking of mascots, we've seen lots of them at the NCAA tournament. I got to tell you, I don't know about you guys, but my bracket's starting to get busted up pretty badly. One of my Final Four picks is already out. I picked Kentucky to make the Final Four. They lost. They were a 2 seed, lost to the 15 seed. St. Peter's is one of the Catholic schools, one of the 11 Catholic schools in the tournament this year. And I talked about that this week as well on the show. So I don't know if I'm going to win the office pool this year after all, but you never know, man. I might make a strong comeback at the end. Well, thank you for joining me this week on the Cale Clark Show. I really appreciate you. Appreciate the listen. If you missed an episode, by all means, you can binge listen to the podcasts on the weekend. You can go to relevantradio.com. You can also get them on the app, wherever you get your podcasts. If you listen on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, why not give us a rating and a review? Helps people to find us. And the same is true for the Faith Explained program. We've been having a really fun series on the Lord's Prayer, the Our Father, breaking it down, kind of doing the Our Father in slow motion. There's a lot of richness there, so those episodes are there for you as well for the Faith Explained show. Jim Shaper produced. Maggie Greschel took your calls today. God bless you guys. Have a great weekend. Take it away, Michaela.
Thank you for listening to my daddy.